My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to say how pleased we are that you have joined us for this teleclass. Today, our teleclass is inside the International Federation of Infection Control. Now, last year, a marvelous lady from Holland named Gertie introduced me to the International Federation of Infection Control and to the annual conference that was held in Malta. It was a fabulous conference, and it is an amazing organization. And at the head of this fabulous and amazing organization is a fabulous and amazing leader. Patricia Lynch is a remarkably capable person. She has been in infection control for a very long time and has worked in a great many countries around the world. As the chair of the International Federation of Infection Control, she travels the world to support the IFIC member societies. But even before her involvement in IFIC, she's made a very big impact as an infection control professional and author and speaker. It is indeed a treat for me to be able to share this time with her. So to present the teleclass, Advances in Global Infection Control Inside the International Federation of Infection Control, from Seattle, Washington, I am pleased to present Patricia Lynch. Pat.
Thank you, Paul. And thanks to all of you for joining this teleclass. I'm really glad for the opportunity to discuss global infection control with all of you. 10 years ago, I couldn't see global infection control as a possibility. You remember what that was like then. Really difficult communication, particularly internationally. There were very few infection control societies. There wasn't much drive in many countries to address the problems of hospital infections. It was hard to see the possibilities. But now, in this last year, I know with certainty that it's not only happening, it's coming fast. And it can be made even faster and more effective by what we do as individuals and as members of our national infection control societies. If you look at the changes in the last 10 years, internet communication and improved teaching tools and information, the pressure of emerging infectious diseases, which has given infection control a huge boost and emphasis, and the risk for transmission of those diseases in healthcare facilities, tied in with the huge increase in infection control societies around the world now, things are looking much more positive. IFIC is the International Federation of Infection Control. It's a member network composed of national infection control societies and corporate members. In infection control, effective networking, which is the optimal flow of information, energy, and support, is a major cause for success. National and regional infection control societies create the structure within which effective networking happens. Imagine infection control in your own country without your own national society. It would just be a huge gap. You can't imagine how some things would get done. So the national societies are the glue that holds a lot of infection control in each country together. But before we can talk about IFIC, we need to talk about infection control in general, hospital infections, and infection control programs. Unless the hospital infection control programs and the national societies address hospital infections directly and really add value to the programs, there's no point to them. Without any doubt, and documented by NICE research, infection control is one of the great successes in healthcare. Really big success. It saves money for hospitals and for patients because infections are very expensive. And risk for infections can be effectively reduced, often dramatically, in the first phase, in practically everywhere. Infection control is a fundamental indicator of quality. In other words, if a hospital has relatively equal staffing and relatively equal facilities, the one with the best infection control program wins the prize. And infection control definitely reduces unnecessary death and illness. Today, global infection control is a possibility, yet global outbreaks of infection occur regularly. Hospital outbreaks are similar in similar circumstances, but the education and training to prevent hospital infections are also similar in similar circumstances, and this allows development of training, education tools, information, posters that need very little modification from country to country to address the basics. There are some key questions about hospital infections that still remain. And the first is, what is the prevalence of hospital infections? And second, what are the patterns of their occurrence? Because prevention strategies are always targeted toward patterns of occurrence. And last, what don't we know? Lots of times we think we know quite a bit and don't ask the question, what don't we know? And it's very important. This is a nice table that Samuel Ponce de Leon developed for the last edition of Richard Wenzel's book, Prevention and Control of Nosocomial Infection, the 2003 edition, which was reviewed in the last issue of the IFIC Bulletin. This is an abbreviated version of Ponce de Leon's table, but you can see that the incidence of hospital infections has been reviewed in a fair number of countries. I left a lot of them off to make it fit on the slide, and I know a lot others that weren't published in his table. But you see, first of all, that if you look at 1995 Mexico and 2003 Argentina, the two ICU studies, that the rates are well above 20%. In other words, at least one out of four or five patients who enters an ICU departs with an infection. The other multi-center studies, 1985 Mexico and 1996 Brazil, are quite dissimilar. And you find that when you look at studies done in a variety of countries, they may not use exactly the same definitions and they may not use exactly the same methods. So you see differences, but you still see relatively high rates. The global burden of hospital infections, then, has at least two major parts. One is that infection problems are amplified in hospitals. Now, this is something that's kind of hard for people, particularly healthcare workers, to understand. But if you think of the possibility of sending your three-year-old to a large daycare center with the hope that it will reduce the number of upper respiratory infections in your family, you get the idea of amplification. Kids who go to daycare centers come home their first 2 years with runny noses, and everybody in the family gets it. Hospitals are the same way. If you remember SARS, for instance, between 40 and 70% of the cases were hospital acquired. Hospitals are amplifiers for communicable diseases and also for multi-drug-resistant organisms, unusual pathogens that don't occur frequently in the community, such as Clostridium difficile and Acinetobacter, and a variety of other things. Hospitals are the amplifiers, and all healthcare systems in the world spend most of their budget on hospitalization. This is a problem. Long hospitalizations are the norm in many countries. In Japan, for instance, I think the average length of stay is still over 25 days. They don't know the real cost, which is opportunity lost for better spending choices, plus the increased infection risk of all kinds. Global health issues that remain with us are insufficient financial resources for healthcare, period, not just for hospital problems, but also for community health and basic public health issues such as sanitation in many areas. In the developing countries, a disproportionate burden of the preventable cost and the disease occurs because their small budgets are more likely to be overwhelmed by the hospital costs and costs of complications such as infections. There's a real failure of facilities of all sorts, not just hospitals, to use the proven and inexpensive strategies to reduce risk. There are all sorts of studies published all the time on why people don't comply with proven practices, which continues to be a problem. And last, there's inadequate training for healthcare workers in many parts of the world, particularly nurses, even in countries where medical school education is adequate for physicians. You often find completely inadequate curriculum for nurses, and thus they're not really able to manage the decision-making that's necessary in high-technology, high-acuity-of-illness hospitals. And then there is so much that we don't know. And here are a few of those things. We don't really know what are best practices, because best practices reports, you know, like the CDC guidelines or guidelines from the European guideline producing organizations and other places, really are internally inconsistent. In other words, within their own guidelines, they sometimes are out of agreement. And they're often inconsistent with each other. So somebody will recommend one and somebody else with equal weight and equal importance will recommend another thing. The biggest flaw, though, is that none of them really describe where and when and for what conditions these are best practices. So you can find Category 1 recommendations, to use the CDC terminology, for preventing urinary tract infections, and then you find Category 1 recommendations for surgical site infection, but there's no internal ranking system to say that this particular Category 1 for surgical site infection is more important than 27 other things on the list. And the surgical site infection guideline has 23 Category 1 recommendations. Some of them are undoubtedly outranked by recommendations for preventing, for instance, catheter-associated bloodstream infections. Some of them are probably outranked by other things. In other words, if you only have a dollar to spend, where should you put that dollar for the best results? And this isn't known. And when I contact experts about how programs that are just beginning should address this, they don't have any answers. So this is an area where research is really lacking and where a sufficient number of thoughtful people have not sat down together and tried to work it out. Another thing that we don't know much about is what optimizes regional infection control networks. We know from our experience in North America and parts of Europe that when there is an infection control network, such as a national society with chapters, that it optimizes performance in the hospitals that join later. In other words, they get the benefit of the knowledge of the earlier adopters, and how to optimize that in developing areas is not really well known. There are many aspects of antibiotic use that are not understood at all, like how do you really control use without infringing on physicians' individual prescribing rights or their practices. Staffing issues, there are lots of studies that show that staffing has a major impact on nosocomial infections. But exactly what staffing in what circumstances is not that well known. And the staffing mix, that is, how many people with lower-level preparation need to be combined with people with higher-level preparation, for instance, to make a good ICU, isn't as well known. And then the isolation questions that have been going around since the early 1920s continue to go around. And, in fact, if you've read the recent draft guideline of the new CDC guideline for isolation, you see that the question of whether there is more value in containment isolation for diagnosed cases compared to generic precautions for everybody, the question is still not answered, so research hasn't addressed it well enough yet. So the consequence is that about 90% of health research money is spent on about 10% of health conditions, and those include things like hay fever and hypertension and erectile dysfunction and obesity and mood enhancers and sleep meds. Those kinds of things are huge money generators, and a lot of research is directed at them. People in developing countries aren't aware of the risks of their healthcare system, and they don't generate public policy pressure. This is important because even in the developed countries, you often look at how perhaps your very own government spends your tax money and find that you're really out of agreement with how the money is used. But on a global basis, here is a nice example. This is a report from the Safe Injection Global Network, which is acronymed SIGN, and it's coordinated by WHO. A lot of the work is carried out by PATH, the Program for Appropriate Technology in Health. It's funded through a variety of sources, including, most importantly, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and it's to address the huge problem of inadequate reprocessing of injection equipment, specifically needles and syringes, which is common all over the world. If you look at this, look at several things first in order. The first thing is over on the right, and that's the little soak basin with the syringes in it. The syringes are clearly not disassembled. Even if the disinfectant concentration were adequate, the syringes would not be sufficiently disinfected to be safely used. You can see down in the lower right that there are other instruments in there as well, and so people put things in and take things out periodically. And I think I see a trace of a needle toward the upper part of the basin. So the needles are not managed separately or thrown away. They come back again without being adequately cleaned. The second thing to look at is the shape of the bar charts here from Southeast Asia region Group D down to the bottom of America's Group B. There are only about 150 countries represented in these regions, and this is the World Health Organization Global Burden of Disease breakdown, which they use for other studies as well as these on infection related to injection equipment. If you look from the bottom up, you see the pattern of development, essentially, and you would know immediately that Southeast Asia region D and Eastern Mediterranean region D are probably similar economically and in health practices, and that in fact is true. So this apparent similarities that's present throughout the bars is true, and that's how the organization works. Here are the components of the various regions. You can look and find your own region and also go through quickly and see what countries make up which region. The ones that have underlines under them are the ones that I know for sure have infection control programs. Some of them are members of IFIC, some of them aren't. Some of them have been in the past and still have their infection control program, so I left them on. There are probably some that I have missed. In other words, they have an infection control program and a national society, and I simply don't know about it. But you see that AMR Group B is the Caribbean and some Central American and South American countries, again, probably with similar economic and health circumstances. And then Europe Group B, you're not going to find in any of the global burden of disease the Northern European countries and Canada, the U.S., in other words, the highly developed countries are not part of this. There's about 150 countries in here, and you're not going to find Sweden or Denmark or the U.S. or those kinds of countries. Next slide shows Africa Region D, America's Region D, and Europe Group C. Africa Region D is a huge number of countries, and you don't see much in the way of underlining. IFIC has had some contact with infection control people in Cameroon. We've gotten some contact with people in Mali. Not much from any place else, nothing from Niger, Senegal, any of those. We do have contact with people in Bolivia, but not Ecuador, Guatemala, Haiti, Nicaragua. There is a very active infection control organization in Peru. And, in fact, in the first week of October of this year, they're having their every other year Pan-American conference. Southeast Asia, Region B, Africa, Region E, and Western Pacific Region, Group B, are all in here together. I won't go through all of these. You can see the large number of countries that are similar economically and in their health practices. And see that if you could make some changes in these groups, it would have a very large global impact. Eastern Mediterranean Region Group D and Southeast Asia Region Group D. These are getting into countries where poverty is much more of a problem, they're politically unstable, have wars going on, much more difficult to be able to make substantial changes in those settings. Although even there, the Infection Control Society of Pakistan is having a conference I think it may be their first national infection control conference this winter at the end of December. The Egypt Infection Control Society is, I think, maybe 12 years old and has annual conferences every year. India has an infection control society, but India also has, it's just an enormous country, very difficult to even consider how to address infection control at this point. Now, the reason we're going through all of these is on the next slide, and that is a large number of studies have reported an association between injections and hepatitis B virus infection. And there's no need to go through all of these studies except that you see that they are from around the world, that the lead investigator for several of them is Yvonne Hutan, who is the first author of the paper that these slides are drawn from. And on the next slide, you see the proportion of new hepatitis B virus infections attributable to unsafe injections in the year 2000. About 35% of the new HBV infections in the world, about 22.5 million, are believed, with fairly sound epidemiologic investigation, to be due to unsafe injections, in other words, reuse of inadequately sterilized equipment. If you mentally move that bar in the middle over so that it coincides with Southeast Asia Region B, which is down toward the middle there, and mentally move it up, you see if you could really impact all of those to the right of that and eliminate them, that the proportion of new bloodborne pathogen infections in the world would decrease in huge proportion. So it's a very important problem, one that Safe Injection Global Network is mounting up projects to address all over the world. And of course, it impacts not only hepatitis B, but also hepatitis C and HIV infection and whatever other bloodborne infections exist but have not been identified yet. Huge problem, and one that there is known technology to deal with. So if we don't focus research on the problems of obesity, hay fever, hypertension, and those kinds of diseases, then what would really benefit hospital infections particularly? The focus of research that would benefit hospital infections includes defining the magnitude and the patterns, the epidemiology, in other words, of hospital infections, and then developing specific projects with results that transfer to other similar settings. The infection control network idea, prevention of surgical site infection and catheter-related bloodstream infection, for example. Improvement of education curriculum, again, particularly related to nurses, to fill the gaps that exist in nursing curriculum in many parts of the world. And then some cost and benefit studies. Once hospitals know the cost in terms of morbidity and mortality and potential liability, and the benefits which can be obtained at fairly low cost, then there's considerably more interest in developing small to medium-sized projects that do focus on prevention. So that should be the focus of research. And if money can be won to point in this direction, there will be really good benefits. The cost of nosocomial infection in a number of countries has already been pretty well defined, particularly the U.S., Canada, the U.K. Mexico's had some good studies. I know of several others. But the cost elements are very clear in all countries, and that includes the longer length of stay, the expenses that are directly paid out by the patient and family, increased treatment cost, increased use of the lab and radiology department, the greatly increased cost for infection control investigations, epidemic investigations, exposure investigations, increased cost for litigation, and more currently, particularly in the developed countries, lost hospital patronage. As more countries begin to publish the epidemiology of hospital infections, in other words, their score, as it's commonly called, people will choose based on similar hospitals, similar circumstances, similar facility, but lower risk for complications and infections. And I think this is a good thing. So the cost estimates for hospital infections in several countries are these. Plowman et al. Reported in the UK that 7.8% of hospital-associated infections identified in the hospital and 19% after discharge cost about 2.8 times the same cost for matched cases who were uninfected. That is about $5,000 each in U.S. dollars. So the national U.K. cost is about $1.6 billion annually. The U.S. has a fairly recent report, 1999, that was published by the Institute of Medicine, which combined infectious complications and non-infectious complications together for a cost of between $17 and $29 billion. In Mexico, and this is interesting, the excess length of stay makes a total cost per infection greater than that reported by the UK, and that's partly because the length of stay stretches out considerably longer in the Mexican study than it did in Plowman's study. So that runs up the cost quite a bit. And remember, Mexico was one of the countries that had ICU study too. So you wonder, who are the effective change agents in getting things improved? Well, first of all, governments are rarely a powerful force, even in the highly developed countries. Those of us in Canada, the U.S., Northern and Western Europe, we can squeak to our governments about how we need more money for hospital infection control, but it very rarely comes to pass because individual hospitals or even well-known hospital infection control people speak out. The non-governmental organizations, WHO, Pan American Health Organization, and private foundations are slightly more responsive, but still not really good. Individual hospitals, in all countries, usually in the capital city, there's at least one hospital that is just absolutely right on in practices, facilities, staffing, everything. It's the model hospital. And oftentimes, these model hospitals reach out to others within the city or within the region and have a great impact and become effective change agents. But the most important change agent in improving infection control in a nation or in a region is a local infection control society. They're the major source of education and support. They make the major requests for funding changes and practice changes. And so, to my mind, the most important thing to do to improve infection control in the world is to increase the number of effective infection control societies around the globe, and that's a major effort for IFIC. As I mentioned before, IFIC is a federation of infection control societies. There are about 190 countries in the world now, give or take a few for political changes, and about 70 to 80, as near as we can tell, have infection control societies. 53 of these belong to IFIC. Our member dues for country for societies to join is $100 a year, and that's beyond the reach of a fair number of countries. And so quite a few of the newer infection control societies have not joined IFIC. The IFIC vision and mission, first of all, our vision is that every nation has a functioning infection control organization. Not just a functioning infection control organization, but an effective one, and that IFIC provides the essential tools, education materials, communication that unites the societies and fosters the development of IC organizations where they're needed. This is a very large task, and to understand what we're doing and what the problems are, let me talk about IFIC goals and then also the structure, how IFIC is organized and how it's funded. The IFIC goals for 2003 to 5, in other words, for the next 2 years, essentially, to do more to unite infection control societies and agencies to reduce infection risk globally, to get people really interested in this and working on it, to fund scholarships for infection control training. Often, particularly in a small region, a single person with advanced training can have a huge impact. Some of you who've been in infection control a long time can remember back to early beginnings, and one person in a city, for instance, would go off to a conference and bring back all the materials and then host a meeting in their hospital meeting room and present all of this information and talk about how are we going to do this. And it was had a great impact. We like to provide low-cost and essential education materials, and we find that if we keep our materials basic, they can be translated and reproduced in a number of countries. I think our basic booklet is in 10 or 12 languages now. We'd like to host an infection control congress with more than 100 countries represented and a huge range of co-sponsors. One of the problems in developing countries is often being able to see the products that are available, so it's important to have corporate co-sponsorship for large conferences. We haven't come close to 100 countries yet. I think we had 50 countries at our last conference in Malta, which was just a very successful and outstanding conference, but still well short of 100 countries. IFIC wants to publish appropriate and timely information in print and on our website. And if you haven't gone to the site lately, I hope you do drop in and take a look. And to partner with all of the available organizations to foster national infection control societies. Our major overriding goal is to get more effective infection control societies in the world. The structure of IFIC, and this may surprise you, is that the board is comprised of 10 members. There are three officers, which are the usual. IFIC has a very traditional business model. There's a chair, which is me for the next year or so, treasurer, secretary, seven directors who do all of the other tasks of chairing committees, editing the publications, and running the conferences, doing projects. So if you look carefully at that number again, it will look to you like there are 10 people doing just about all of the work, and that in fact is true and is one of the major flaws of IFIC. The IFIC election process, our member societies nominate one of their members to serve on the board. Sometimes the sitting IFIC board will ask a member society to nominate a specific person who has skills which the board needs. The nominating society pays expenses for their elected IFIC board member. In other words, since I'm from the U.S., APIC, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, agreed to pay my expenses, including my travel costs, for the years that I serve on the board. And you can see that that would put serving on the board beyond the financial reach of many of our member societies. The term of office is 4 years with an option to serve another term for a total of 8 years. People can resign during the course of their term, and when they do, we can elect to either fill the slot by acclamation from the board or to elect. 2004 is an election year, and we have two candidates nominated. So, isn't this pretty? Here we are. If you look at this photo, you see on the left Moira Walker from Canada, who is retiring after 8 years of just exceptional service this year. The next photo over shows Dr. Nizam Damani, who is from Northern Ireland via Pakistan. And I think this was taken of the two of us at the conference last year. I can't quite figure out where it is, but it looks like last year's conference. And the next one definitely was. That's Dr. Ulrika Rancha from Sweden, who's seated next to me. And in the next slide, starting at the bottom right, you see Dr. Gary French from the UK and his wife. Moving to the left, Dr. Smilja Kalanich, seated with Dr. Peter Heeg, who is retiring this year, seated with his wife. And next to them, Dr. Osama Roslin from Egypt. Moving up, there's Dr. Michael Borge in the middle, hoisting his glass in a happy moment after the Malta conference was over. He was the chair for that conference and worked very hard. Moving to the right, the first person is Pamela Allen from Northern Ireland, who is our administrative person, and she is with Gertie Van Knippenberg from Holland, who edits the bulletin. And they're standing beside a physician from Libya who came for his very first conference. Libya doesn't have an infection control organization, and he was there as an observer to see how infection control organizations work and how the conference was. Nice fellow. The final picture is Pamela Allen again, and Dr. Smilja Kalanich. Dr. Kalanich is the chair for the IFIC conference in Poreč, Croatia this year. IFIC has some staff. Pamela Allen is our part-time administrative officer. We have recently, in the last year and a half, hired a representative of an organizational management firm, Fitwise Incorporated, and our representative is Mr. Blair King, who's working with us for fundraising, improving our structure for patron members, and making our organization more valuable. And we have one outstanding volunteer website director, who is Dr. Sergei Aramin from Russia, who runs the website and the website communications. IFIC has had a fair number of conferences now, and they're listed here. The 2003 in Malta, 2002 in Edinburgh was a Me Too conference with the Hospital Infection Society of the UK. And this is something that IFIC most commonly does, which is partner with a local infection control association to put on the conference. Our 2001 was in Cairo, Egypt, with the Egyptian Society of Infection Control. And in the year 2000, we were in Croatia the first time, and that's with the Croatian Microbiological Society. We met in South Africa in 1999, and at the Malta conference, on the next slide, you see that I have 45 countries. I think it was closer to 50. Nearly 400 participants, so it was a large conference for IFIC. We like to have them fairly small so that all the people have plenty of time to talk with the lecturers and to talk with each other. It was great lectures and discussion groups, as Paul said, and social events that really fostered friendships, and I know many of the people are still in touch with each other. Next year, on the next slide, or this fall rather, 2004, will be in Poreč, Croatia, which is away from Zagreb, the capital, where we had our last conference, and down on the Istrian Peninsula in the Adriatic Sea. The conference website is posted on this slide, and I hope you've had time to take it down. I'm going on to the next slide, because IFIC 2005 will be in Istanbul, Turkey. The Turkish Microbiological Society has hosted several IFIC conferences over the years under the direction of Dr. Özlem Ang. This will be October 13th to 16th, and it's being hosted by the same organization, the Turkish Microbiological Society. I believe the Turkish Infection Control Society is also lending a hand with some of the organization and speakers, but the major organizer is the Microbiological Society. A couple of years ago, last year actually, we started a scholarship fund to get people to major conferences. One of the biggest problems that people have in beginning infection control societies is getting a few people to international conferences so they can learn how to organize conferences and make progress in that way. Our scholarship applicants are required to do a research project to prepare an abstract for poster or oral presentation. These are judged and ranked, and then the scholarships are awarded in the order of ranking. Our conferences are usually held in low-cost countries, and so a scholarship is generally about $500, and that covers their registration, hotel, meals, and usually there's a little bit left over for travel, but most commonly they have to find their own travel money. Next slide shows our 2004 award winner, who was Justin Fombe from Cameroon. IFIC publications include our fundamental infection control book, Basic Concepts. It's written by IFIC board members and invited experts. We revise every few years. Next year is a revision year. It's available on the website, and it's available for translation at no cost to member organizations. Member organizations just sign an agreement that they will translate it exactly as it is written. That is, they will not put in new material or change existing material to fit their national patterns. They have to do it as it is as written by us. Information resources in infection control is edited by Dr. Damani, and it's a compendium of print, web, and organizational resources. It's a terrific resource. You can look up website addresses. It's well indexed, and you can find websites of the various publishers and the like that you like to find. Dr. Aramin runs the bulletin, and I mean the IFIC website. And again, I urge you to drop in and have a look. Gerti edits the IFIC bulletin, which is published 2 to 3 times every year. We're just in the process now with our organizational assistants, with Fitwise, of evaluating other methods than photocopy and paper to publish the bulletin. It's available on the website, and we send paper copies to our member organizations, but we're looking to sharpen that up a bit and reduce the cost or get better funding to support it. The bulletin is not a peer-reviewed journal. In other words, we publish abstracts from conferences, reprints of important reports and reviews, and non-scientific reports from our member societies. Lots of helpful hints. Gertie's been an excellent editor. I think people find that the bulletin is very helpful to them. And so IFIC is making progress in getting funding for its multinational projects, but it's also looking for help from its member organizations. The 10 of us do good work, but our work could be greatly amplified by more help and also better funding. One of our directions is research projects, and people often ask, well, why would an organization that's so basic be messing around with research projects? And that's because so many of the important questions, and I mentioned several of them on the way through, don't have answers yet. Another is that good projects often bring good funding, good corporate funding, good foundation funding. Practical applications are really essential, and what is practical in the U.S. and Canada and England and a few places like that isn't practical for most of the world. Tiny bits of funding go a really long way, and that's lucky, because what usually gets devoted to hospital infection control after obesity and hay fever and erectile dysfunction and hypertension and acne and sleeping meds is not very much money. One of our research projects is an infection control network organized in Southeast Europe. Dr. Kalanich, who's chairing the conference next year, is the principal investigator on this, and it's funded by a grant from 3M USA and 3M Euro. They have established a communication connection among the 10 countries in Southeast Europe, and they've set up their own forum and website for communication. They have organized and put on one large multinational IC educational conference, and the second one, of course, is coming up this fall. They've developed written content for a basic course for infection control nurses, which will be presented next year, I think. They've surveyed a sample of hospitals in each country to determine the demographics of IC personnel and the training and the tasks that they perform and the infrastructure of the country, like how many hospitals of what size and what surgical capacity. They've translated and distributed the IFIC book, Infection Control Basic Concepts, and they're working on preparing a booklet developing a successful regional IC network to describe in detail and with the cost that they experienced the most effective methods to organize regional infection control networks. It's been a very effective use of the grant money, and once their booklet is finished, it will provide the blueprint for other regions to develop similar networks. I have another one that's still looking for funding, but is well underway anyway. Dr. Geeta Mehta from India is the principal investigator. And the questions were, working with limited resources, how to develop and test educational material on surgical site infection prevention, and determine whether the CDC guidelines, the 23 Category 1 guidelines, can be implemented by what proportion of hospitals in developing countries. And so there's a fairly large survey underway to determine that. It's still unfunded, so they're working on a shoestring. What can IFIC member organizations contribute? First of all, translation and printing for basic concepts. It's just one of the most useful tools to go out to developing countries. An example, I've just sent the materials to Vietnam. They have a fair number of people who are interested in infection control, although they haven't developed an infection control society. They do have a volunteer physician who will translate the material. The printing costs for a country that size, I would guess, to be about $1,500. Of course, they don't have the money, and so I'm in the process of searching for a grant to get printing and distribution for that done. Thailand has a very active infection control organization, and the translation has been completed, and BD Company has just offered to fund the printing and distribution for a grant of $1,500. Second thing is conferences that include less developed neighbors and support them. to attend the conference. Often in developing countries, especially international consortiums that put on conferences, English turns out to be the most appropriate local language. It's never most appropriate for conferences. For example, a conference in China would not be put on in English. But a conference that included many China and many of the Southeast Asian conferences, such as the Asia-Pacific Society for Infection Control, those kinds of conferences are always put on in English. And so support from our IFIC member societies who can contribute to putting on these conferences is very welcome. The member organizations can also attend the IFIC annual conferences and present important papers and posters. In other words, if the research is done in a developed country, yet it applies to countries that are just beginning infection control programs or regions, then those are certainly good abstracts to come and be presented at IFIC conferences. They can provide support for IFIC scholarships. This has been terrifically important in the last couple of years. Many local chapters of APIC, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, and chapters in Chica, Canada, the Swedish Infection Control Society, Dutch Infection Control Society, and a number of others have provided a $500 donation for a scholarship for an individual to come to an IFIC conference. And some are asking if they could be partners could we set up some partnerships with people who are just beginning infection control programs? And the answer, of course, is yes, we can. If the local donor organization is willing and eager to contribute that kind of support. And last, writing support articles for the IFIC Bulletin is really important. When infection control societies support each other, and when we do projects together, and when we publish together, infection control is really going to move around the world. And it's essential that it do so, because you saw the quick transmission of SARS from China to Southeast Asia to many other sites. You see transmission of tuberculosis frequently following the same lines, following immigrant pathways, following visitor pathways. You see influenza go ripping through developed and undeveloped countries alike, virtually in the blink of an eye, with hospitals and healthcare facilities playing a major role in transmission. So it requires contribution from all of the developed areas and all of the less developed areas at the same time to really accomplish the improvement that we all hope is going to take place.
Thank you very much for a fantastic and excellent presentation and for taking us through the work of the International Federation of Infection Control. Clearly, IFIC is becoming more and more influential and more important in global infection control. And you as leader, you really have done a tremendous job. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, my. I'm walking in the steps of a number of people who have gone before. And one of the lovely things about infection control is that all of us are standing on the shoulders of people who have already made steps up. So it's not due to me. It's a confluence of circumstances.
You're being modest. You have made a tremendous influence, a tremendous impact as well. Pat, it seems you're always either going to something or just coming back from something. Can you tell us what's going on in Thailand? And if you want to comment a little bit on the Pan-American Infection Control Conference.
Starting with the Pan-American, it's being held in the first week of October. It's exactly the same time as the IFIC conference. So none of us on IFIC are going to be able to participate much, but we have promised ourselves that we will be in touch and not set up our conference on top of each other again. Their conference is every other year, and ours is annually, and we'll work it out. The Pan-Americans have quite an active infection control conference, a lot of international speakers. It's a very good program. Thailand was just a wonderful experience because I was there in 1991, which was just before the National Infection Control Organization began being really effective. Now, this last conference, there were maybe 600 people in attendance. It was 2 days of workshop, which was intended for doctors and nurses who actually do infection control, and then several subsequent days that included directors, included their joint commission process people, and was a much more multidisciplinary approach to look at infections. I've toured hospitals in Thailand, and of course there's great diversity as there is anywhere. They're making great strides at addressing particularly sterile reprocessing and things like that. If you look in AJIC, American Journal of Infection Control, and ICHI, Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, you find many Thai authors reporting original research. They have just moved into a very dynamic, active phase right now. It's just very nice to see. They also have a number of interesting projects, including some that address the problems of AIDS orphans in a really innovative way. They're geared toward children who are HIV positive, who are abandoned by their families or have parents who have already died of the disease, which is common in African nations particularly. And some of these are such good programs that I feel sure that they'll be prototypes that many organizations can adopt and use as the problem of AIDS orphans increases. I think that World Health Organization estimates that by the year 2010, there will be more than 25 million AIDS orphans in the world. Other agencies estimate considerably higher, and the highest estimate that I've read was close to 100 million. That included children who are effectively orphaned, that is, their parents are too ill to support them, and the children, in fact, support the parents, and children who are abandoned by their families, and children whose parents have died and no one in the family has taken them in. So huge, huge problem. I was delighted to be able to participate.
On the list of funders, in the latest newsletter that came out, there was a list of organizations and societies and people who had given money to the International Federation. What I found interesting was that there were lots of Chica and APIC societies. There were also individuals and corporations.
Yes, individuals and corporations have begun supporting the scholarship fund particularly.
How do people go about doing that, and what kind of funding level is given? Do people give $100, $500? What's done?
Most generally, because of the problem of exchanging currency, smaller donations than $100 are somewhat difficult for us to manage because we have to change the currency and there's a cost to that. Chapters generally collect money, or infection control societies collect money and then send it. The modal donation is $500, and that's what individuals generally ask. You know, could you accept a donation of $500? And $500, as I said, is enough to have a really large impact on providing a scholarship, but it's also enough to partially fund translation and printing of basic concepts somewhere.
That's $500 US.
Yes, $500 US.
It has again been my honor to host this teleclass today, and I'd like to thank you all for coming together in this way, as you do on a very regular basis. And a special thanks to Pat Lynch for a tremendous teleclass presentation. Until we meet again, folks, stay safe. Goodbye.